it's important to understand just how 35, 40 years ago, the idea of an institute that wanted to convene discussions and policy debates around the role of the private sector probably left a lot of people scratching their heads.
The Manhattan Project allowed the United States to defeat Nazi Germany.
We're going to be doing one thing, and one thing only, killing Nazis.
Project Apollo put a person on the moon.
It's one small step for man.
And hastened the defeat of the Soviet Union.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Today, I think that Western supply chains are more vulnerable to China than most people realize.
Let's say China.
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 The question that I kind of have is, does the U.S. even want to stay a superpower?
China.
Welcome to the Minerals Manhattan Project. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch, and I'm joined today by Jeremy Martin, the Vice President for Energy and Sustainability at the Institute of the Americas and one of my favorite buds to chat geopolitics with over a beer anywhere in the world. Welcome to the podcast, Jeremy.
Oh, man. I appreciate the invitation, and that's a wonderful introduction. And let's raise a virtual glass when we're done here.
That sounds like a good time. So, Jeremy, to get straight into some of the topics that we're talking about today, in your role as the VP at the Institute of the Americas, you and I have had a lot of conversations about the United States versus, quote, the Americas, unquote, and China. Can you talk to the audience a little bit, just like what's the Institute of the Americas and how does the history of, I guess, the Institute reflect the history of the Americas?
What do we have, 3 hours to do this podcast? So I'll take an hour on.
Listen, everybody's in quarantine. We can talk as long as
exactly.
We want.
So I appreciate that. I mean, let me just quickly give the shameless plug. And the Institute of the Americas, where I've had the pleasure of working for over 17 years now, is, you know, I don't like to call it a think tank, but people seem to understand when you use that terminology. But the bottom line is former U.S. ambassador to Argentina named Theodore Gildred founded the Institute over 35 years ago with the aim of improving relations and focus on investment and economic development in the Americas. But really, the idea was that we're all neighbors in the hemisphere. We're friends and allies to a large degree. But we oftentimes, especially 35, 40 years ago, barely understood what the heck was going on in one another's country. And so it was, at the end of the day, a market-based effort in looking at the role of the private sector, but it was really about trying to deepen understanding across the Americas. And at the core of that's trust. And the better you know one another, the better you get to know each other culturally, language-wise. There's trust that emerges. And so, you know, the founder was a businessman, a developer. His son, Ted Gilger III, is the president today. And we continue to have at the core of that bettering the relationship and understanding the role of commerce and economic development. So hopefully that explains a little bit of the founding, and we can get into why that's relevant and where that feeds into our work today.
I'm no historian, but 35 to 40 years ago would have been right in the third quarter, I guess, of the Cold War. How does that influence how the Institute came to be? Or what are your thoughts on the Cold War, besides spawning some real, real good films and music?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, and I'm a bit older. My gray hair probably makes people think I'm even older than I am. However, I'm not so old that I was hiding under my desk or that my family had an underground bunker to deal with potential nuclear attack. But, you know, look, the founding of the Institute was in the Cold War. It was at a period of time of major geopolitical games and geopolitical developments around the world. And as a matter of fact, one of the most interesting things is the founder of the Institute, Ted Gilger, Ambassador Ted Gilger, when he went to Argentina as ambassador under President Ronald Reagan, he was arriving in Argentina that was not long removed from the Falkland Islands, the Malvinas conflict with Great Britain. And so, you know, it's amazing how far we've come in some ways, but in other ways, you know, we continue to have, at the end of the day, major, major geopolitical developments. Now, the one thing I also want to put on the table here as part of this, the founding of the Institute was remarkable for all the reasons we just talked about, but in terms of also when we think about the role of private sector in Latin America. And if you go back 35 or 40 years ago, it was either non-existent or very limited, right? I mean, these have historically been state-run economies state-dominated economic development models on a state-run basis. And so right around the time of the Institute's founding in the mid to late 80s was this major, major paradigm shift. It was the end of the lost decade of the 80s with the debt crisis for most countries in the region. And so there began this debate over, wait for it, privatization. So we can take that forward and have a further conversation, but it's important to understand just how 35, 40 years ago, the idea of an institute that wanted to convene discussions and policy debates around the role of the private sector probably left a lot of people scratching their heads.
So Jeremy, I'm going to kind of play with time a little bit. That was back then where we were talking about, you know, these are state-run, you know, top-down economies using privatization and the free market to unlock productivity, if you will. And as we're talking about Argentina and the United States, if you fast forward to today, specifically this week, when we got to see Contango, which is not just a type of dance from Argentina, but it's where oil is trading negative. Essentially, oil futures are negative, or the future price of oil is less than the current price of oil. Honestly, I just like it because I learned it like
You like the contango, the word.
I learned the word like a week before this happened. And so I've been able to just like pepper it into conversations to make people think I'm a lot more knowledgeable than I am. But sort of going to a place where oil prices are low to the point of negative future prices, you're seeing both the United States and Argentina promote policies that would essentially subsidize non-profitable, non-conventional fracking oil and gas. You know, essentially saying we'll pay, in Argentina, they're saying we'll pay $45 a barrel, even if world prices are negative. So what's happened since, you know, we were going to bring privatization to those banana republics to unlock their productivity, to having a U.S. president that's essentially announcing what frankly looks almost Peronist from down here in my closet?
Yeah, what is Peronism anymore? Yeah, look, I think the whole neoliberal model as an economic prescription, privatization, capitalization, the converting of inefficient, bloated, corrupt state-run enterprises to either private, you know, ownership of the a portion of private ownership has been, over the past 15, 20 years, hotly debated. There have been some great examples of success. There have been some examples of less than stellar privatizations. I mean, I think, you know, that's its own topic of the sort of, you know, the efficacy of privatization and did it achieve the original goals as sort of spelled out by the quote unquote Washington consensus and all that. But the fact of the matter is we're now in a moment where, to your point, presidents like Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico will use the term neoliberal much more as political rhetoric than any kind of understanding of what does that mean in terms of economic development theory? What does that mean in terms of macroeconomic policies for a country? And so at the same token, he's criticizing neoliberalism and he's criticizing all the previous neoliberals. He's doing some things in a fiscal manner in terms of austerity that folks who subscribe to the precepts of the Washington Consensus would applaud. And would applaud him and applaud his government's efforts. Obviously, there's a whole host of things he's doing otherwise. So point being, it's useful to use terms like neoliberal and it's useful to use concepts like the Washington Consensus to have discussions. But what happens in reality, and you know this firsthand in Argentina, is an entirely different situation. Because the last neoliberal president, just a few months ago, Mauricio Macri, well, he, the last few months in office, did stuff that, according to the neoliberal playbook, was absolutely anathema, right? I mean, the price freezes, all the things he did with monetary policy the last few months. So point being that what's a neoliberal anymore? What's a statist anymore? I think it's all up for discussion. And this leads back to the point of where are we today with the United States? And there's no doubt about it that this administration is inward looking and wants to focus internally in whether it be with immigration, whether it be with our support of or participation in NATO or multilateralism. There's a real aversion for this crowd in Washington today.
You know, it's really interesting to see some of these, like, you know, Macri espousing, I guess, being pro-Washington consensus, sort of a neoliberal champion of the IMF, if you will, all of a sudden, you know, when shit gets tough, turning on his, I guess, his theory, right? In theory is one thing, but practice doing a totally different thing. And it kind of reminds me of a quote that I've been kind of bandying about that seems to hold really true currently with what's going on in the United States, is that it seems to me, at least, like some of these proponents of the free market and, you know, capitalism and, you know, the capitalist system is what drives resources to the most efficient uses, is this idea that we actually are advocating for capitalism on the way up, communism on the way down, or capitalism on the way up, socialism on the way down, right? It's all fine and good to pull yourself by your bootstraps until oil's cheap, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's crying for the government to bail out oil.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way. Say that again. It's capitalism on the way up and socialism on the way down.
Or communism, depending on how much you're trying to piss off the people you're talking to.
Yeah, I would argue also, and this is what my students get tired of me hearing from me, I should say, is that policymaking at the end of the day is derived from politics, right? And so it's impossible, and I think we see this ever more so these days, it's impossible to decouple or disconnect the intersection of politics and ultimately policymaking, right? You know, the idea of electing a group of technocrats who will then come in with a whole host of stimulus measures and policies that will drive the economics and development and all these things. I mean, at the end of the day, so much of that is not policymaking in of itself based on white papers or research. It's based upon politicians and politics, right? And so, you know, when a politician gets elected on a platform that's rhetorically of a certain nature, then that gets translated, or then his team has the challenge in some cases to translate that to policymaking into policies, right? And so that's where you see, well, is Macri this? Is Lopez Obrador that? Is Bolsonaro a nationalist? But is he a, you know, a neoliberal?
He's definitely an asshole.
Oh boy. Emily, no holds barred podcasting. I love it. No,
but look, I mean, in one of the coming to, you know, coming of age moments I think I've had over the last couple of weeks is sort of a disappointment in American leadership,
right,
in a global crisis. You know, I was raised
American exceptionalism.
American exceptionalism, you know, be all that you can be, go for it, you can do all this kind of, you know, is being replaced by something that doesn't look like the values that I grew up with as an American in the 90s, right? As a child of the 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted to bring this back to looking at the Americas, a topic that you and I have discussed.
Yeah.
Ad hominem. That means a lot, right?
Yeah, as long as it's not an ad hominem attack, yes.
It is not an ad hominem attack. But one of the topics you and I have discussed is sort of China's rise on the global stage, but especially as an actor in the Americas and coming into the Americas with a type of debt diplomacy. You know, while we were all focused on Russia and focused on the Cold War, then after the, you know, end of the Soviet Union as a threat, in the time from, I guess, the falling of the Berlin Wall to today, has China crept up in our backyard?
Yeah. So the China, you know, the minute you put China into the conversation, it's like a cocktail or dinner conversation when the word Trump these days comes into it. You know, it's radioactive. Different people have different thoughts on it. But let's take it. Let's start with the U.S. And again, in repeating this, that we are indeed in a moment, whether you can call it sort of the Trump effect or whatever. But it's a moment of looking internally. It's a moment of not wanting to be part of multilateral trade agreements, multilateral organizations, multilateral whatever the case may be. It's America first, right? So that's It is a political policy-making rhetoric that is taking shape. Now, President Trump is great at talking out both sides of his mouth. So on the one hand, you know, we're doing all this. But on the other hand, he's also being very delicate at how he approaches China right now. And there are some China hawks in the government who probably are advocating a much more averse or confrontational posture these days, given COVID-19 and what have you. But I think Trump is, you know, again, talking out both sides of his mouth, blaming China, but yet wanting to continue with that amazing trade deal he's supposedly pulling off. So the role of China in the Americas, though, also leads to one idea that people always have, that the United States doesn't pay enough attention to Latin America. And that's sort of a broad brush, you know, oh, the U.S. is so focused on the Middle East and the U.S. is so focused on other parts of the world. The U.S. ignores Latin America. That's such a routine criticism. You hear it all the time, particularly from folks in the region who want more engagement. But with that said,
we just want attention, Jeremy.
Yeah, but that's exactly what I was going to say. But the point is, the minute you see some kind of engagement, it's always interpreted as imperialism, or not always, but often it can be interpreted in ways that are very negative, right? So point being, what is the right engagement? And I think that's obviously where China comes in as well. China went into Latin America and has been in Latin America for several years with an enormous commercial engagement, right? With enormous financial and commercially oriented engagement, whether it be locking up energy reserves, whether it be locking up markets, whether it be locking up sort of countries geopolitically in terms of their camp. More recently, it's all fallen under the umbrella of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is this massive agglomeration of countries across the world, you know, sort of this recreation originally of the Silk Road and the idea of the commercial route in Pan-Asia. But now it's this way to bundle up countries of interest across the world, right? And I mean, again, look, Mauricio Macri during the campaign, a few years ago, there probably wasn't anyone stronger against China and said he would change the way Cristina Kirchner had managed Argentina's relationship with China. Well, I don't have to tell you that when he came into office, he not only continued a policy, but Argentina participated in the Belt and Road Initiative, doubled down on some infrastructure loans and investments, nuclear, rail cars, these kinds of things. So since 2005, China, according to this great database that the Inter-American Dialogue puts together, has put something like $140 billion into Latin America. Most of that from a state-directed China National Development Bank and some other state-run companies. Around half of that into Venezuela, obviously, primarily to garner oil and secure oil assets, because, you know, China has an insatiable appetite for energy and oil. And so what is the U.S. doing to counter that? Well, that's the whole challenge here. Yes, we have the Trade Development Agency and Ex-Im Bank and what used to be called OPIC, but we don't have anything on the scale or the checkbooks that China's had. And that's been sort of seen in this enormous amount of money that's been poured into the region. So it's not just convening a summit. We do that pretty well. We have the Summit of the Americas that began in the Clinton years of the 90s, but there's no real money behind that, right? The free trade area of the Americas. Okay, ostensibly there's commercial activity and money behind that, but there's no real enormous amounts of money that are just being directed to infrastructure, to energy, to projects as the Chinese do. And so, you know, it's a very, very different engagement. And I'll stop rambling here by saying, somebody on our webinar earlier today, we had with Jesse Edmondson, he used the term long game, talk about China. This was on critical minerals. But I think that's the perfect way to summarize it. They have been playing the long game for many years. I mean, China is an ancient, you know, country, an ancient society. They know how to play the long game. The U.S., we're not very good at the long game. In fact, we're terrible at the long game. We want quarterly returns, yearly returns. What's our investment return? And so it's a much different way of approaching it. Sorry if I rambled a little bit there, but a lot to...
There's nothing to be sorry for on the Minerals Manhattan project. The topic that I want to go into is, what do you think is the difference between the concepts of multilateralism and leadership? Or what's the relationship between those two terms?
Well, I don't know is the simple answer. but here's my... What do we call it this day? Hot take? Here's my hot take.
Take. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
This is what gets you those high marks on RateMyProfessor.com.
Here's my hot take, you know, which leads me to think about a great Austin Powers moment when he, you know, gets up and starts dancing the Macarena. He says, I'm hip, I'm with it. You know, and he proves it by dancing the Macarena. So I'm going to prove how woke I am by giving a hot take. What was the question? Oh yeah, multilateralism versus leadership. Well, again, I think this comes back to, what has a politician in a campaign rhetorically and to gain political support done? And right now, attacking multilateralism, attacking the idea that the collective and working together towards a common goal and objective is less important than working directly internally for your own constituency population. So that's how that's my hot take on it. And so play that out, Bolsonaro in Brazil. He doesn't really care. All he cares about is the constituency that got him elected, that led him on a pretty rapid ascension in Brazilian politics, right? Carving out a base that led him to the presidency. Obviously, no one has to have me explain the Trump model, but López Obrador as well. I mean, here's a great factoid that I'm sure people who follow closely know, but it's still remarkable. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador took office on December 1st, 2018. How many times has he left Mexico since that day, Emily?
Zero.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, Trump may say America first, but look, AMLO is Mexico first, and he means it, man. He's not even going to leave the country. That's how much he believes in Mexico first. So leadership versus multilateralism, I don't know. I mean, what is leadership anymore? I've given up trying to understand it.
Listen, Jeremy, a fun fact is I was rejected from the National Honor Society during high school, and I had a letter that says, because I lack leadership ability. Not a joke. The subject at hand, as sort of a student of, you know, I did a lot of history related work in college and grad school, and a lot of these multilateral institutions were born out of World War II, and they were the platform. Bretton Woods, right? They were the platform upon which U.S. leadership manifested itself in the globe, but they were also like at their roots was this idea that we shouldn't have another world war. So I guess I'm curious as to your thoughts on, is the U.S. pulling back from its leadership commitments globally and then specifically in the Americas? And how do you see that going forward? Do we have, you know, does somebody fill the leadership void? Do we have no leader? What's the next step?
The simple answer is the U.S. pulling back. Yes. I think so. But again, I think we see this talking out of both sides or wanting to have it both ways, right? And so, yes, we're pulling back. However, President Bolsonaro and President Trump are like-minded, as we diplomatically say, have an affinity for one another, have an affinity for how they're each running their countries. And so although we're pulling back and although there's a, you know, retract or a sort of distancing from the idea of multilateralism, in certain cases, there's an embrace of bilateralism, right? And Brazil and the U.S. are probably closer now today than they've been in a long time. I mean, historically, the foreign ministry and the Itamaraty in Brazil, I mean, the Brazilians and the United States didn't like each other at all in the international arena, right? And
Well, it used to be the BRICS, right? Yeah. We used to have Brazil, Russia, India, China, and sometimes.
Yeah, so that's one element of a sort of, you know, a group of like-minded emerging economies that formed a quote-unquote block of areas of interest. But, I mean, the point being that you know, Bolsonaro and Trump. So the whole relationship and why the U.S. hasn't pulled back with Brazilian-United States relations is because of Trump and Bolsonaro. It doesn't really have a whole lot to do with broader U.S. strategical goals or interests. I mean, yes, there's energy relations. Yes, there's commercial interests. But those would be absolutely cast aside if not for the sort of bilateral presidential affinity. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the idea of the Bretton Woods and, you know, one of the great titles of a book ever is President the Creation, which, so if you're President the Creation of something like Bretton Woods, I guess you get to write a autobiography or biography, and it's called President the Creation. So yeah, it was a momentous, you know, set of institutions that were put in place. And by the way, you know, we talked earlier about the Washington Consensus. Well, Washington Consensus is derived from a whole host of institutions, or the ideas of the Washington Consensus are derived from a whole host of institutions that were created at Bretton Woods, more or less, in a certain way. I think you have seen an evolution in the last few years of, well, what is the model? What is the international model? You know, I don't know.
I want to pivot to, you know, in terms of the multilateralism and the decline of leadership and what that does for the Americas. Let's bring energy into it. So how is your role at the Institute of the Americas looking at the energy transition, and how have you seen it since you decided to take that on versus where you see that? I make a joke, but when I did my lithium talk at your event last year, I have never, ever in my life given a talk to so many grumpy looking people who had like a crump, like a real frowny face with like their arms crossed real tight in front of their chests, because it was mostly the oil and gas folks. How, you know, talk to me about the energy transition and what you mean by that.
Unbundling some of that, it's a fascinating time that we're living in. Obviously, that goes without saying. But even before the coronavirus crisis, you know, we were starting to see in the last few years a major, major shift in how the world produces, consumes, and thinks about energy, right? And so that's how I sort of talk about the energy transition. Look, we've been through energy transitions in the history of man for a long time, right? From different energy sources to different energy sources, right? Some of them are longer than others. So that's one of the big questions. This energy transition we're in now, what's the pace? What's the timeline for this transition? And it's a transition from a huge dependency and reliance on extremely, extremely efficient fossil fuels in terms of energy, in terms of generating energy for what we need it, to a renewable, less polluting, less carbon intensive, some would argue less destructive use of energy resource. What's the timeline of that? Well, that's where it becomes even more fascinating, right? Because in the Americas, you have obviously several countries that have enormous challenges with poverty. In fact, poverty and addressing the issues of poverty, probably one of the most important challenges in the hemisphere. You have some countries that are just unable to deal with creating economic opportunity for their citizens. So what's then a just energy transition? And that's one of the things I think when we look at the Americas, you have to understand, because we've spent 100 some odd years developing an energy sector and developing an energy paradigm around fossil fuels. And so if we stop thinking just from the consumption and the utilization side to the production side, that's where it gets extremely complicated in the Americas. And we have to be very open-minded, because there are countries and there are economies that have developed, some again would argue inappropriately, dependencies on the fiscal and the economic returns from oil and gas, right? So how do you transition all of those economies, and how do you transition the consumption of those to renewable resources? Now, the good news is in many of these markets in Latin America, you have just as much as there is a wealth of fossil fuel resources, there's an enormous wealth of renewable resources. I mean, Latin America has some of the best wind opportunities and some of the best solar, some radiance penetration and opportunities for deployment of wind and solar in the world. So there are huge opportunities, and those are going to continue to be at the core of the discussion. So now, what's the day after the coronavirus? We've fundamentally, it seems, changed how we're consuming and energy and how we're working and how we're living our lives. Now, we're forced to do that by government policy and edict at this point. But what does that mean for the day after? What does it mean for citizens? What does it mean for policymakers? And what's going to be the role of this energy transition, this transition from a century-old fossil fuel-based system to a much more renewable, less carbon-intensive system? And that's going to be extremely important for governments as they consider fiscal stimulus and as they consider rebuilding, how to balance those provinces in Argentina that are practically broke or are broke and have such a need to produce oil just to generate some income versus what they could do in terms of an energy transition. So the day after is going to be hugely important, and choices that countries make and choices that governments make in terms of policies could really, really either expedite the energy transition in Latin America or continue to put it on a slower pace.
An interesting similarity between energy markets that has come up in a couple of my conversations this week is that with physical oil going negative because there's nowhere to store it, there are similarities to places like northern Chile, where you have, and even in Germany, I've seen where sometimes the solar, because of the large penetration of solar energy, electricity prices go negative for certain periods of the day because essentially there's nowhere to store it. And I found that to be a very just interesting understanding of how undeveloped or unsophisticated our financial markets for energy are. If we you know, the oil has a value if it's underground, but not if, you know, if it's been pumped out, but not in the ground and with the sun and with it, you know, storage and transportation, they matter.
So two things. One is I think I could even argue after the last several days that we actually, with the way trading and oil, you know, trading and oil markets operate, is it too complex? I mean, we've taken, you know, anyone who tries to, unless they're actually in the middle of it and understand, it's very hard to explain what happened with the negative price for future delivery versus the offtake versus physical versus, I mean, it's hugely complex. And there's people who are, you know, betting that it will go up, and there are people who are betting it will go down. I purposely stay away from that. It's just, I'm not smart enough. But the
point, are they, Jeremy? That's why this is happening.
That's why it's negative 37. They were too smart. But coming back to this question of storage, it's fantastic, because think about it this way, Emily. If I say to you storage, I just use the word storage, and I say, hey, let's talk storage. My guess,
underground bunker.
Nuclear fallout bunker, right? No, my guess is if I say to you the word storage, you're going to go to batteries. You're going to start thinking battery storage, the use of storage for electricity. If I say storage to somebody else who's much more of a hydrocarbons orientation, they're thinking about tanks. They're thinking about, you know, ships sailing. They're thinking about Cushing, Oklahoma, and how much more tanks can they build to store the oil. So storage maybe is the word of the week or the word of the year. And it has.
The thing is, Jeremy, though, it's the same problem, just at radically different time scales.
It's the same problem, but it cuts across the sector, the energy, the broader energy sector at different places, right? I mean, there's not a technological issue with oil storage. There's just a physical storage issue, right? I mean, right now there's too much oil and there's not enough physical places to put it, storage. And I would argue the sort of energy transition in the electricity space, it's much more a technological hurdle we're working through and getting over in building the storage that could be commercially viable and of a scale that could really, really, really allow for huge scale generation to be stored and then put back into the grid or then consumed. Do you think?
What if you were to be out of, let's say carbon footprint were not a, or carbon emissions weren't something we were counting. What if we ran out of, what if we essentially converted the potential energy of the petroleum by generating electricity and storing it in batteries? It's the same problem. It's storing. I'm not saying we should do it, but as an academic exercise, that converts it into the same problem, right?
Yeah. Okay. So then you bring in policies and policy making and also economics that maybe are being altered because of the low price of oil. But we've pretty much decarbonized in the sense of power generation, or we've reduced the use of fossil fuels. Now, natural gas, we always have this debate. Is it a cleaner fuel? Is it not? You know, everyone has an opinion on that. But the point is that petroleum-based electricity generation, with maybe a couple of exceptions in the world, in places that I wouldn't encourage you to go visit.
Or I've probably been to all of them.
Exactly. probably tape some podcasts there. Good ambient noise, I bet. No, but the point is that petroleum oil as a power generation source out, you know, that's as old news as the founding of the Institute, you know.
I wanted to, though, when you look at kind of the role of energy, right, one of the interesting things about China playing the long game is that China is an energy intensive economic growth model, and they don't have access to petroleum. So in terms of geopolitics, they have a drive to find a solution to that energy problem in a way that maybe countries like the United States with access to petroleum don't.
Yeah, well, they don't have enough, right? I think it's more as their demand, you know, blew through the roof and they overtook the U.S. and, you know, number one consumer. Not enough, right? I mean, you know, I can only imagine the scale of the Chinese economy. I mean, obviously, maybe a little bit easier to comprehend the scale of the Chinese economy today. But point being that, you know, they had no choice but as their demand soared to go out and lock up the access to supplies. I mean, at the end of the day, people talk about the geopolitics and the political affinities of the leaders of Venezuela and China. At the end of the day, Venezuela has the world's largest in the ground oil resources potential. China locked up a whole host of those resources on the back of 60 some odd billion dollars in loans, right? If we want to be just really straightforward, that's what it is. That's what they did. So to your point, China looked around the world and said, where can we make sure that as our economy booms and our consumption and demand for oil and oil products grows, we make sure that we're going to get it? Well, we're not going to do that in the U.S. because, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with that. We have this whole host of issues there. Boom, Venezuela, you know, Brazil and places in Africa. So it's really not that complicated, is it?
No, the prize.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I know we spent a long time talking this podcast, but it's actually sort of, you know, one and one equals two.
Energy is power.
Yeah, it's the great game. I mean, and so that's, I think, a fascinating thing if we go back to the energy transition. And I think what's so interesting is, well, what's the new geopolitics, right? And that's where you and I've talked a lot about, and where we've now getting into the critical minerals. And you look at how China is exerting control over the value chain of critical minerals. So we're all of a sudden transitioning, not just in terms of the consumption and use and what sources for energy, but then the inputs and the raw materials. And all of a sudden the great game, the geopolitical dance, becomes not so much about locking up oil and gas reserves and making sure you control those markets, but the inputs for the renewables, right? The inputs, not just for batteries, lithium, but the graphite and all these other elements and materials and minerals that go into the wind farms, the solar panels, right? You know, so you can honestly, and people have already begun in the last several years looking at this, the geopolitics of renewables, or the quote unquote new geopolitics of energy.
Jeremy, we are unfortunately running low on time. This has been a very interesting convo. I just have one more question for you.
My favorite book? No.
No. How
top three movies?
How hopeful are you?
I'm sorry.
How hopeful? Those are critical things too, I'm sure. But how hopeful are you about the next 15 years? Like what tell me about your relationship with hope right now?
I don't know her that well. I've heard good things. Oh, sorry, that's a terrible joke. Hope is an interesting word, right? And I actually have a lot of friends and our mutual friends who criticize me because they say I'm too hopeful. And criticize me because I say, I believe in humanity. I believe in the solutions that we'll always find. Mother's necessity of vengeance. So I believe in hope. I believe in the glass half full cliche. And this reminds me of a debate that was going on for years about peak oil. You know, and people would just work themselves up into a lather, and just there was books and there was whole camps of people who were absolutely.
My racist uncle got me one of those books for Christmas once.
The peak oil. I mean, it was just a full on, you know, in my position on that was, and it wasn't because I was so informed or technologically involved in the oil business, but rather from a standpoint of technology and development, that there would always not be a lack of oil. It'd be about the ability to find the oil and access it, right? And technologically, we've done that. Now, has it been the best way to do it? Whether you argue about offshore, deep water, and all that kind of thing, and fracking. But again, we did it. And so does anyone talk about peak oil today? No. So
my racist uncle might still.
Yeah, but. Well, he's probably moved on to other stuff like, what's that, QAnon, or what is this nonsense? Or
yeah, I mean, he's probably, you know, I think that the Tea Party... something.
Does he have a Gadsden flag, you know, the yellow one with the don't tread on me?
The don't tread on me. One of my racist uncles does.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Anyway, so my favorite book, Path Between the Seas.
All right. Are you going to get it for me?
Sure. My lifetime goal is to read that book in Spanish.
Cool.
Not because it was written in Spanish, but just because it's an enormous book that I really enjoyed and read a couple times.
Was it written in Spanish?
No. It's David McCullough. It's written in English. And unless there's a side of David McCullough I don't know about.
You never know, Jeremy. Life is.
You never know. I mean,
life is full of surprises.
Charles Lindbergh and Charles Kuralt seemed to pull it off. So, you know.
I was actually complaining to a friend of mine that I felt like I wasn't using the quarantine well, effectively, like brushing up on my Chinese that I'd learned some of last year. And he's like, well, look, Emily, if this round of quarantine, you don't do it, there's always the next one.
Yeah. No, I think you could possibly right now move to Georgia or Florida. South Carolina. You'll have a pretty, I'd say within a few weeks, maybe another major quarantine effort.
Listen, Jeremy, I am a strong bowler, so Georgia might be a good spot for me. Jeremy, if people want more of your book or movie recommendations or to check out some of the lovely presentations that the Institute of the Americas is going, do you know your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle, because I'm such a dork, is @JerMartinIOA.
The Institute of the Americas Energy is @IOA_energy. A lot of good stuff happening at the Institute of the Americas, especially when it comes to the energy transition and the mineral foundations that are needed to get there. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch. I'm on Twitter @LithiumPodcast. The Minerals Manhattan Project is on mineralsmanhattanproject.com, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, basically anywhere that someone wants podcasts. Jeremy, this has been really fun, and I hope that you agree to come back to the Minerals Manhattan Project, and maybe someday we'll be able to do this in person.
No, thank you so much, and I had greatly looked. Talk about hope. I had hoped to see you at the end of May here in La Jolla for our annual energy conference, the one you talked about, you know, making people so happy last year. But we'll do that online. We'll do it virtually, and you and I will keep talking as we always do. So thanks for recording this time that you and I were kibitzing.
No, podcasts are a fun way to keep in touch with people and to share thoughts and ideas. So
I'll give a shout out to my parents, David and Natalie Martin, because, you know, the only way I'll know if they listen to this is if they hear this shout out.
I'm right now worried that my racist uncles are going to listen.
I'll
talk to you soon, Jeremy.
Bye.
The Minerals Manhattan Project is hosted by Emily Hirsch and produced by Emily Hirsch and Elena Peach. To continue today's conversation, follow Emily on Twitter @LithiumPodcast and visit our website @batterymaterials.energy. Enjoyed today's episode? Please share with others and rate the Minerals Manhattan Project on wherever you get your podcasts. Have content suggestions or interested in being featured as a guest in a future episode? Please contact us via our website or the Twitters.